Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Wednesday, December 14th, 2016. Beginning with international news, a ceasefire deal with rebels and the Syrian government in Aleppo has collapsed.
نعم كمال يعني نحن اخترنا اليوم أن نكون من أمام قلعة حلب الأثرية. طبعا سنتحدث عن هذه القلعة وعن الدور.
Fighter jets resumed bombing raids over the city. The Syrian Observatory on Human Rights says the clashes are particularly violent. Both sides are accusing each other of breaking the ceasefire. Iran is asking for evacuation protocols to allow Shiite residents to leave, and it seems unless those conditions are met, there will be no ceasefire in Aleppo. UN war crimes investigators said the Syrian government bears the main responsibility for preventing any attacks and reprisals in eastern Aleppo, and that it must hold to account any troops or allied forces committing violations. They say the threat to evacuate residents most likely constitutes war crimes. Meanwhile, reports say women and children have been executed by pro-government forces. This as they close in on the last remaining neighborhood still held by opposition groups. Jocelyn Sambira reports.
The UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, says it has received reports that numerous bodies lie scattered in the streets in formerly opposition-held Aleppo, and that at least 82 civilians, including women and children, have been killed by pro-government forces. OHCHR spokesperson Rupert Colville was speaking to journalists in Geneva as Syrian government forces and their allies continue their assault on the very last opposition-held areas in the east of the city.
Civilians have paid a brutal price during this conflict, and we're filled with the deepest foreboding for those who remain in this last hellish corner of opposition-held eastern Aleppo. While some reportedly managed to flee yesterday, some were reportedly caught and killed on the spot, and others were arrested.
While numbers are difficult to verify, it's believed that thousands of civilians are sheltering in formerly opposition-held areas of the city. These include activists and civil defense members who the UN Human Rights Office warns are at risk of grave violations, including detention, torture, and killing. In a bid to avoid this and the suspicion that massive crimes may be underway in Aleppo, the UN Human Rights Office wants to get monitors in to observe the Syrian army and its allies. On the humanitarian front, the UN and its partners are continuing to push for aid access. But Jens Larke from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, has warned of a complete meltdown of humanity.
We do have information that there are still thousands of civilians there who may be hiding in basements wherever they think they can find shelter. And given what we have just heard about the reports of alleged extreme human rights violations against civilians, of course, our concern is for their safety and security.
Mr. Larke described Aleppo as an entity that changes by the hour and warned that it was not a situation where humanitarian concerns had the upper hand. Jocelyn Sambira, UN News.
The UN Human Rights Office said civilians have paid a brutal price as the Syrian military and its allies take back the city. Today, the Independent International Commission of Inquiry said alongside a pattern of indiscriminate attacks with rebels preventing civilians from leaving, they are embedding themselves within the local population and in the process heightening the risk that they would be killed or injured. Paris is turning off the lights of the Eiffel Tower this evening. This is a gesture of solidarity with the citizens of the Syrian city of Aleppo hit by this humanitarian crisis as residents are fleeing heavy fighting. Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo said this is a symbolic measure at a building known worldwide, and it will aim to once again alert the international community to the need for urgent action. And this is the news on WBAI in New York. Here in the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, released a report which it says is based on science. It examines the relationship between hydraulic fracturing and drinking water. The report, Hydraulic Fracturing Drinking Water Assessment, was commissioned back in 2010. This as the surge in fracking fueled a boom in production of oil and natural gas. It says, yes, fracking does pose a threat to drinking water, and the agency identified 1,600 chemicals which are used in the fracking process. It concludes that 11% of these chemicals pose a threat to human health, and while chemicals used in fracking have been closely guarded industry secrets, the EPA says next month they will publish a database listing these chemicals. However, when we asked, they did not provide any insight into the relationship between clusters of health problems in areas with large numbers of fracked wells. Jeffrey Frithson is Associate Director for Ecology at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He says the EPA followed the water cycle.
We defined a hydraulic fracturing water cycle that begins with water acquisition. Where do people get water to use for hydraulic fracturing? On to the second stage being that chemical mixing stage where water, chemicals, and proppants are brought together at a site to prepare the hydraulic fracturing fluid. On to the third stage, which is well injection, when hydraulic fracturing fluid is introduced into the well under pressure to frack the rock that's down below to release the product of interest, oil or gas. On to the fourth stage, which is produced water, that water that comes back out of the well when pressure is released. And then the final stage of the water cycle being, what do we do with that water? Wastewater disposal and reuse. EPA's study has been consistent. What we have done is to follow the water.
Frithson says impacts on drinking water were found in all stages of the fracking cycle, from water acquisition on through well injection through to wastewater disposal and reuse. But the EPA says they don't have sufficient information about the impact of spills of fracking fluids and chemicals.
Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of information on the ultimate fate of many spills. We do have some listing on spills that occur. We do have some listing that, and we do have evidence that spills of hydraulic fracturing fluids have reached surface water, and we have evidence that spills of produced water have reached groundwater. But we don't have good information from which to characterize the rates of spills here. There is some information that we bring together that shows a spill frequency rate of about 0.05 to 2% that have the potential to reach drinking water resources, but there's a large range on that and a lot of variation.
The report calls into question the integrity of some of the wells used in fracking. It found that about 0.5 to 1% of the wells are poorly constructed. When you consider that, according to a 2015 study, 1.7 million wells are in the U.S., that's at least 1,700 wells which may be leaking.
In most cases, there is a multitude of mechanical barriers, either the drill casings, the well casings themselves, or the cementing between the annuli of multiple casings that form barriers for fluids leaking from the inside of the well to the outside of the well and therefore having the potential to contact drinking water. It is where those barriers break down or are inadequate that we are most concerned about.
Other areas of concern are how fracking affects groundwater resources and the disposal of fracked and chemical wastewater, as well as unlined disposal pits. The report says impacts generally occur near drilling sites, and they range from temporary changes in water quality to rendering private drinking wells unusable. And while the EPA says their report is based on science, they may have bowed to political pressure. Back in 2015, they issued a preliminary report. It said fracking poses widespread systemic impacts. Now the report concludes fracking can impact drinking water resources under some circumstances. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is trying to line the EPA with fracking enthusiasts and climate deniers. One of Trump's questionable picks announced today is Rick Perry as Energy Secretary. Perry once called Trump a cancer to the presidency. He's a climate change skeptic with close ties to the oil industry. Once Perry proposed abolishing the Energy Department, Donald Trump has promised to revive oil and gas drilling and coal mining by cutting back on federal regulations. He's also said he would pull the U.S. out of a global deal to curb emissions of carbon dioxide, which scientists say contribute to climate change, to rising sea levels, droughts, and more frequent violent storms. Trump's transition team said the president-elect cited Perry's tenure leading Texas, the nation's second most populous state and a major producer of oil, gas, and wind power from 2000 until 2015. Trump said in a statement that Perry created a business climate that produced millions of new jobs and lower energy prices in his state, that he will bring that same approach to our entire country as Secretary of Energy. Perry would replace Ernest Moniz, a physicist who was one of the chief negotiators in last year's Iran nuclear deal while energy secretary. The department is responsible for U.S. energy policy, and it oversees the nation's nuclear weapons program. Rick Perry says he looks forward to engaging in a conversation about America's energy future. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Close to home, New Yorkers are fed up with the school-to-prison pipeline, with the system of incarceration in New York State, which destroys people's families and communities. This week, community groups from across the state came together to demand a comprehensive policy platform of change to empower and protect the rights of New Yorkers. On any given day, 75,000 New Yorkers are in New York State prisons and local jails.
Ain't got no money for bail, shouldn't mean I go to jail.
And many can't afford bail. Lorenzo Brooks is with Parole Justice USA. He says bail is supposed to be affordable.
The only reason for bail is to secure the defendant's presence at his next court date. It's supposed to be fair. It's supposed to be affordable. But that's not happening in our courts today. The courts are setting the bail so high that a person can't make it.
What Brooks, who spent 30 years in prisons throughout New York State, wants to see is sentencing put back into the hands of the judges, and he wants to see cutbacks in lengthy sentences.
The legislators could limit all sentencing to 20 years. We could also shift a lot of these resources back to community-based prevention and treatment for substance abuse. Also, investing in interventions to that promote strong youth development and respond to delinquency in age-appropriate and evidence-based ways. We could also examine and address the policies and practices, consciousness or not, that contribute to racial inequality at every stage of the justice system.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, these prisons and jails have got to go.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, these prisons and jails have got to go.
Hey, hey, ho, ho.
The rally on the steps of City Hall this week comes on the heels of a New York Times investigation. It found a depth of racial bias against people of color in New York State prisons. It found racial disparities in who was granted parole, and it found that in most prisons, blacks and Latinos are disciplined at higher rates than whites. Since the report, Governor Cuomo says he is opening an investigation into abuses.
All right, let's chant again together. Goes like this: old Jim Crow, new Jim Crow, the whole damn system's got to go. Old Jim Crow, new Jim Crow, the whole damn system's got to go. Old Jim Crow, new Jim Crow.
Johnny Perez is with Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement. He works to close Rikers and for the Halt Solitary Confinement Act. That's legislation sponsored by Harlem State Senator Bill Perkins, among others. It restricts the use of segregated confinement and creates alternative therapeutic and rehabilitative confinement options.
We can all agree that we want to live in a society which values our humanity, which values our dignity. We can all agree that we want to live in safe communities where people are free from harm and torture and free from cruel and unusual punishment. The problem is that we live in a state where people are subjected to to torture every single day right here in our state, not in some foreign third world country, but right now, as we speak, we have up to 5,000 people that are currently in cells that are no bigger than your average bathroom. These people are locked in there for 23 hours a day with little to no meaningful human contact, no access to programs, and no reason to address the issues that got them there in the first place. How do I know this to be true? Because I, myself, was there for 3 entire years. There's people sitting right now, not in some foreign country, but right here in our backyard, 200 yards right from LaGuardia, in a place called Rikers Island, or should I say Torture Island, where people are spending $167,000 a year per person, per bed, and yet these people are faced with injustices day in and day out. Not only women, not only men, but also children too. Yes, I did say children because we know that we are one of 2 states who hold the age of criminal responsibility to be 16 years old. Now I tell you, if I take my daughter who's 16 years old and lock her in a bathroom and feed her 3 times a day cold food through a metal slot, I'll probably be arrested. See, I also know what it is to be locked inside of a cell in a correctional facility. Not necessarily Attica, but I'm speaking specifically about Attica, where all these injustices and the brutality and the racism, and thank you, New York Times, for pointing that out, but guess what? Because people just like me, or maybe 2.1 million people that are currently incarcerated, know that these injustices have been going on since the beginning of time. See, I know, just like the many other men and women know, how it is to wipe boot prints off your kids' pictures when they wipe them off the wall. See, I know what it is to buy drugs from a correction officer who then turns around and threatens to put you in solitary confinement if you don't pay them on time. See, I know what it is to console my mother when she comes to visit me after taking the Q100 for hours and being subjected to dogs and security checks and magnometers only to be able to contact me and look at me and talk to me for an hour. I remember she said, "Johnny, I wish that I can take you out of here. I wish that I can help somehow, some way." See, what we need, and part of the solution is that we need legislators who will be as progressive as they claim to be. See, unfortunately, we have a mayor who says that he is progressive and that we live in a sanctuary city, but how can that be possible when in our own very backyard right now as we speak, there are probably people being subjected to the tortures that we call Rikers Island? And some people don't survive. I can name a few, right? I can probably name a few. Right, Khalif Browder is probably one of them, right? Who didn't survive the torture that we know to be Torture Island, right? We know Jerome Murdo is another person, right? We know Bradley Ballard is another person, and again, the countless men, women, and children who don't make it to the news, who don't make it to the faces of our TV screens, where we're aware of these issues, not necessarily because of what they did, but because of who they are. And I'm talking specifically about people that look like me, talk like me, have the same skin color as me, specifically black and brown people. See, right now, as we speak, we have legislation right now called the HALT Act, acronym H-A-L-T, the Humane Alternatives for Long-Term Isolated Confinement, and it seeks relief in 3 distinct ways. One, it limits the people that go in solitary in the first place. Right, these vulnerable populations that we feel very so comfortable just locking them away as if they're trash. And I'm talking about people who are locked in there for 23 hours a day. Also, secondly, what it does is that it creates an alternative in the form of rehabilitation residential units where people will be able to get the proper treatment, the medical care, and address the issues that got them there in the first place. And more importantly, as it relates to solitary confinement, is that it limits the amount of days that they can spend in there in the first place to bring it in line with international standards. Because we also live in a state that keeps people not only in solitary for a week, a month, a year, but for decades at a time. My friend Robbie's been in solitary for 12 years. I don't even know what he looks like because we were playing chess for 6 months through the vent. I don't even know if he's alive. But yeah, we feel comfortable with that. We feel comfortable electing public officials who don't necessarily practice what they preach. And this is important because with the incoming administration, things are going to change. And we can no longer stand by and allow things to happen. See, we can no longer stand by and allow the injustices and the oppression to not only dehumanize, but the brutality right in our faces. And guess what? We're not going away. Are we going away?
No.
What do we want?
Justice.
When do we want it?
Now.
See, this is not just advocates or a few people who are radical. We're talking about human lives right here. Lastly, what we need to do, and we don't need reform. We don't need to fix up the buildings. We don't need another investigation to tell us what we already know. What we need is action. The only way to fix Rikers Island and Attica is to do what?
Shut it down.
Is to do what?
Shut it down.
How do you fix Rikers Island and Attica?
Shut it down.
My name is Johnny Perez. I'm with the Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement. Thank you.
All right. Let's hear it. Hey, hey. Ho, ho. These prisons and jails have got to go.
Hey, hey. Vivian Nixon with the College and Community Fellowship and the College from the Inside Out says with President-elect Trump, there is no more important time than now to stand up for our human and civil rights because they are under attack.
And one way that we stand up for our community and our civil rights is by being empowered as a community. At College and Community Fellowship and the Education from the Inside Out Coalition, we believe that one of the ways that we gain power is to educate ourselves. And I'm not just talking about formal education. Though we support higher education in prisons and after prisons, I'm talking about civic education. Because a lot of the reasons that the election ended up the way it ended up was because people did not have the capacity to understand that many of the things that were being promised to them were not only blatant lies, they are impossible to do. They're impossible for one man in one position to do because we operate in a government with three branches. We operate in a government that is accountable for how it interacts with the rest of the world. But so many people didn't understand that. So I'm here today to promote actions that provide education to people inside of prisons, to promote actions that don't deny people education when they get out of prison, and to promote voter education, voter registration, and the restoration of voting rights to all people who have been incarcerated, no matter what state they live in. And we are a nonpartisan organization, but I do know that there are enough people who have been denied voting rights across this country that could have swayed counties, could have swayed states in a different direction, no matter what that direction is. We can no longer believe or agree with or even accept the idea that once you commit a crime, you cease to be a citizen of this country. We still live here. We still work here. We still pay taxes here. We still contribute to our communities. And the right to vote is precious, and it is guaranteed to us by the Constitution. There's a couple of ways out of the situation we're in. We have to start demanding one person, one vote, one voice. The Constitution needs to be re-examined as a living document. We need to understand that the clause in the 13th Amendment that says I can be a slave if I commit a crime is not about human rights. It's about vindictiveness and punishment. We need to understand that perhaps the Electoral College system is outdated and no longer needed in this country. This is the kind of education we need to give our people. Because if we don't stand up for ourselves, no one will stand up for us. Now, values are something we all care about. And I believe that sometimes people make bad decisions because they're acting on their gut and not on the information. We need to be putting information out there all the time. I want to give you an example of what we can do right here in New York State to make a difference for thousands of people who are currently incarcerated. Most of you know that in 1994, the federal government made people in prison ineligible for Pell Grants, which meant they no longer had access to college programming that not only had the ability to change their lives, but many would have been first-time college graduates in their families, and it would have changed the next generation and the following generation. Over and over, studies have proved that once a generation gets college educated, every following generation does better. Why don't we want people who are incarcerated to do better? Are we asking ourselves that question? When they took away Pell Grants during that same year, Pataki took away TAP grants here in New York State. So people in New York State prisons cannot get funding to go to college. It is not a costly opportunity. It's one of the least expensive opportunities that we're currently fighting for. Less than 1% of the total TAP grant budget went to incarcerated students. But the number of students who had access went from thousands down to hundreds. We need to turn on the tap. And if you want to know more about the Turn on the Tap campaign, please go to the Education from the Inside Out website. Now, we acknowledge that Governor Cuomo has publicly said that he believes that college should be available inside New York State prisons. We know that he is working on that issue with partners across the state. But we need him to be a little bolder, a little louder, a little stronger, and not just depend on private philanthropy and fundraising to run those programs, but turn on the tap. What do we need him to do?
Turn on the tap.
What do we need him to do?
Turn on the tap.
Governor Cuomo, we know you believe in education. Please hear our cries. We are human beings. And I'm here to tell you that the people you see around you today, Johnny Perez, who you just heard from, Glenn Martin, who is successfully running the Close Rikers campaign, many other leaders around this city, like Julio Medina, and countless people that I can name, are not only advocating for justice, but they are leading others in advocating for justice. They have become community advocates and leaders, and they contribute to this city and this state in ways that most people who've never been to prison never do. The majority of citizens get up, go to work, come home, take care of their kids, do what they have to do on the weekends. Hardly any of them are politically active. You're looking at a group of people who, though we have been dehumanized by our communities and our states and put in cages for years, have decided that we still feel like citizens and we still want to lead, we still want to advocate, and we still want to make our society better. Doesn't that deserve some credit? Doesn't that deserve some applause?
The statewide collective is calling on New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo to lead the way in adapting humane policies. The collective outlined 10 specific policy demands for 2017, calling upon the state and localities to transform the policy and practice of parole and bail, raise the age of criminal responsibility and revamp all sentencing, restore higher education access and the right to vote for all, close Rikers and Attica and the torture of solitary confinement, protect domestic violence survivors, and promote racial justice through a Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, December 14th, 2016. The news was produced with Scott Paltrowitz and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.